Mark chapter 10, verses 32 through 34. These words give us the facts behind an incident that I find extremely interesting, especially when I place myself there with the disciples or even with the apostles. Not that I believe I would have been an apostle, but simply to hear what Jesus told them and to see a little later their response, but more than anything, to see how they respond to the statements of Jesus. We understand, as far as context is concerned, that Peter had asked Jesus a question. That question isn't recorded here in the book of Mark, but it is in the book of Matthew. Excuse me. And that question is, when Jesus talks about his kingdom, what shall we receive therefore? And it was predicated by the statement, we have left all and followed thee. And I want you to mark that statement that Peter makes. We have left all and we have followed thee. That's in verse 28. Mark that in your mind. We have left all and followed thee. And Jesus answers the question, or the anticipated question, what are we going to get? This rich young ruler, he came, and when you told him what he had to do, he went away sorrowful, filled with grief. Now, we didn't go away sorrowful. Whenever you challenged us, we left all. That is, we abandoned what we had, and we have followed you. And Jesus told them what they would receive, but there was a caveat that I think brought serious thoughts to their minds, because in all that Jesus stated about receiving a hundredfold, now this time houses and brethren and sisters and mothers and children and lands, the caveat is with persecutions. Now, you're going to gain more than you lose by following me. But what you gain is going to be spiritual, and what you lose is going to be physical. And what you gain will come with persecutions. Now, Jesus is a man, and at that time, as he taught, he did not mince words. He did not promise things that he could not deliver. He did not tell them things that were designed to entrap them from the viewpoint of getting them committed with promises of joy and peace, and then finding out a little later that things were going to turn out badly. Jesus didn't do that. He told them the truth up front and straight out. Jesus said, you will receive these things with persecutions. That is, you're going to be hunted and hounded, and you're going to find that things do not turn out well from your life in this world. Now, with these words still strong in their minds and in their hearts, Jesus did a puzzling thing. The Bible tells us in verse 32 that they were in the way going to Jerusalem with persecutions. We have followed thee. And then Jesus, as he begins his itinerant movement, moving from place to place, town to town, all over Judea, the Bible tells us that he goes toward Jerusalem. Some of the other gospels tells us that he set his face toward Jerusalem. And if persecution is going to come to those who follow Jesus, then why is Jesus turning toward Jerusalem? I believe that the disciples were thinking, that's the wrong way, Jesus. If there are problems ahead, if there is persecution ahead, and you're going toward Jerusalem, then you're headed directly into the source of our persecution. What we need to do is drift a little to the other side, maybe take the opposite direction. Let's turn around. Let's go back to Nazareth or some small town. Or let's do like John the Baptist. Let's go out in the desert. And let's isolate ourselves out there, because we're not going to suffer and be in danger nearly as much if we'll just sort of play this thing quietly. But Jesus, the Bible tells us, was in the way going up to Jerusalem. And the Bible tells us that as they were going, Jesus was leading them. That they followed him, and this is the point I really want us to get this morning, is that they were amazed, and as they followed, they were afraid. They saw the direction that Jesus took, and it really astonished them, and they followed him, but they followed Jesus in fear. I don't think we ought to be too critical of these disciples, because they feared a confrontation with the scribes and with the chief priests and the Pharisees. And the disciples wanted to, if possible, to avoid this confrontation. We don't want to stand and fight. Most of the time, we had much rather drift off somewhere else than to take a firm stand and suffer this persecution that Jesus said would come from following him. We want to take the stance of minding our own business, not get involved, but simply let the blessings of God flow upon us, avoid confrontation, step away from a fight, mind their own business. I think they forgot that following Jesus and going into Jerusalem and suffering at the hands of Pharisees and Sadducees was their business. I think that's the problem we have sometimes. We don't want to in any way compromise what we believe. But it is such an awful thing to become embroiled in controversy, to get embroiled in a fight, if you please. It just, people think that the nature of Baptist people is to fight. But that hasn't been what I have found. I found that many times Baptist people would like to just let things go and let them slip. Now, sometimes Baptists like to fight about the color of the brick or the color of the pew, but when it comes to issues such as believing the Bible, we're not too interested in fighting over that. I can imagine the hesitancy of the step of these people. Jesus has told them, you're going to gain more than you lose, tremendously, 100-fold. You're going to have more brothers than you ever had, more sisters than you ever had, meaning those spiritual relatives that will be ours. But you're going to receive all this with persecution. And then his footsteps head toward Jerusalem. And these people, the Bible tells us that they were in the way going up to Jerusalem, and that duty bound them to follow him, and Jesus was in the front. He was leading the way. The Bible tells us that Jesus went before them, and And you know, when we envision that circumstance, we get happy and start singing. Anywhere with Jesus, I can safely go. We don't mind singing that, or wherever he leads, I'll go. I'm glad we didn't sing that song this morning, Richard. It's easy to sing the song when Jesus is in front. Wherever he leads, I'll go. To sound the phrase, some through the waters and some through the flood, some through the fire, but all through the blood. We can sing that. It's a good song. It's a good thought. And Jesus went toward Jerusalem, and he went before them. And the Bible tells us now that these people are going to Jerusalem. Jesus is leading them. And as Jesus leads them, they are, first of all, amazed. Look at the word. And they were amazed. The word literally means to be filled with awe, to be astonished, either with wonder or fear. Now, they haven't gone very far. But they know the direction. They've been to Jerusalem many times. They know when he took that turn, which city Jesus intended to go to. And they are literally astonished. They're filled with awe. Why is this man headed in the direction of trouble? One translator puts it this way. They were puzzled and bewildered at this. Thank you, doctor. I made the mistake of singing. When I sing, I get... That's a good prescription. They were amazed. They were filled with awe. They were puzzled and bewildered as to why Jesus would make this journey to Jerusalem. And the Bible tells us they were following him in fear. And as they followed, they were afraid. And I wish I could tell you that the word that's translated afraid here meant that they suffered some anxiety, that they were just a little bit troubled, that there were a few things on their minds, that there was some anxiety about what would happen to them, that they were just a little bit trepid about what might happen as they went to the city of Jerusalem. But the Bible, as we read it, as it was given to us, translates to be terrified. These people were following Jesus, and yet they were terrified. And the company who followed were fearful. Now, I want to point something out to you. They were not afraid of Jesus. Isn't it amazing that these people had been with him a number of months? They knew him well, and he knew them, and they were comfortable in one another's company. They'd had some very serious dialogues. They'd had some contradictory arguments, and they had settled these. Jesus had become their rabbi, their teacher. They weren't afraid of Jesus. But you know what? They were afraid of following Jesus. Now you think about that for a minute. We're not afraid of Jesus in the sense of being fearful of his presence. In fact, we sing about it and we long for it and we anticipate it and we speak about it as a means of comforting one another. Where is my father? He's with Jesus. Oh. Where is my mother? Well, she's with Jesus. Oh, that's comforting. Wherefore, comfort ye one another with these words. we use the presence of Jesus as a comforting solace to our sorrows and our grief. When we finally get to be with Jesus, then everything will be all right. These people weren't afraid of Jesus, but you know what? They were afraid of following Jesus. And there's a big difference. What does it mean to be afraid to follow Jesus? I want you to keep that thought in your mind. To follow Jesus in fear. Jesus then took his disciples. He understood why they were afraid. He understood what was in their heart. And he took again the 12. Now, there's a rather large number of people that are encompassed in the word disciples. These are all learners. These are all pupils. These are all students. The Bible doesn't tell us how many, 40, 50, 60, I don't know, 120. There's no specific number that's mentioned. But when Jesus sees the reluctance of the disciples and of the apostles, and no doubt their feet are very, very draggy as they follow Jesus, filled with all kinds of fear, terrified with what's going to happen to them if they continue to follow this Jewish rabbi. But the Bible tells us that he took them, the 12, and began to tell them what things should happen unto him. Not them, but unto him, saying, verse 23, "Behold, we go up to Jerusalem." Jesus used a plural pronoun. He didn't say, "Behold, I go up to Jerusalem," but "we go up to Jerusalem." Now notice what he tells them straight out up front. "And the Son of Man shall be delivered unto the chief priests and unto the scribes." That's the first thing that's going to happen. We're going to be handed over to the chief priests, and we're going to be handed over to the scribes. "And they shall condemn him to death and shall deliver him to the Gentiles." This is what's going to happen to Jesus when they get to Jerusalem. Read it again, verse 33. "Behold, we go up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man shall be delivered unto the chief priests and unto the scribes, and they shall condemn him to death." No beating around the bush. This is plain. You can understand these words. "And shall deliver him to the Gentiles." They will condemn me, and then they will hand me over to the Gentiles. Verse 34, read this with me. "And they shall mock him, and shall scourge him, and shall spit upon him, and shall kill him." But notice, "And the third day he shall rise again." Now, one of the most extraordinary thoughts that you can have concerning what Jesus told them is that these people might immediately melt into tears, that they might immediately fall at his feet, that they might, with all submissiveness, begin to realize the purpose of why this man has come to the earth. Remember, these are Jewish people. They long for the institution of the reign of the Son of David, what we refer to as the millennial, a time of peace and prosperity, a time when God, through his chosen king, rules this earth. They were longing for that. They were That was the dream of every Jew. And these people, though they heard what Jesus said, and though he spoke plainly and to the point without any window dressing, without any caveats about his pain and suffering being some way diluted, he didn't offer anything except the plain, honest truth of who he was and what was going to happen to him. It seems that the apostles heard what Jesus said, accepted no doubt what Jesus said, but they did argue with him. Peter did, at least, as we find out in some of the other Gospels. Peter said, "Not so, Lord. It's not going to happen." And evidently he made a threatening gesture of drawing his sword and saying, "I'm going to defend you. We're not going to let you die. You're the only hope we have. You are the Son of God." He had said that earlier. I know that later, as we read the book of Acts and as we read the church letters and the letters that Paul wrote to Timothy and that Peter wrote to the scattered ones, we understand that they had an absolute total grasp of the plan of God. But here, early, when Jesus spoke these things to them, no doubt it confused them and hurt their feelings, and they'd rather just pass it off and really not pay any attention to it. Because you'll see in verse 35 that James and John, the sons of Zebedee, they took this as being maybe an overemphasis of his suffering or something of that nature, because they said, "We've got something that we want you to listen to." And Jesus said, "What is it?" And they said, "Grant unto us that we may sit one on the right hand, the other on thy left hand in thy glory." So they're connecting these two things with a time when Jesus Christ is glorified, and they just sort of skip over this part in verses 33 and 34. They don't really seem to grasp it, although they realize that to go to Jerusalem is to put themselves in a place of extreme danger. I think what they'd really, really prefer is for Jesus to take them somewhere along the Jordan River in an obscure, deserted place where the grass is green and where it grows tall. Clear, cold water flows just a few feet away. And there in the willows, the birds sing sweetly. Wind blows in the trees. They hear the rippling of that stream. And Jesus teaches them. They can just sit down in the meadow, and Jesus can sit down on a raised place, maybe a rock or something, and they can all just sort of lay back and listen to him teach. Lord, that's so much better. It's so enjoyable to learn about your Father and your contact with him and about the many mansions. Lord, can't we just go do that instead of getting involved in this killing and spitting and condemning and scourging and all of these things? These words they rasp on our heart. They strike terror into us. Couldn't we just go away from all of this, change directions, and just relax? Well, maybe on some deserted hilltop, or maybe the fertile valley of the Jordan. I think I'd like that better than Jerusalem, wouldn't you? I think I'd prefer that. I think I'd choose that. Don't you? But you know, when we choose Jesus and we accept him as the Lamb of God and we accept him as Messiah, we obligate ourselves to follow him. And that's what's happening here with these disciples and the apostles. The great lessons that we must learn from this incident is that there are frightening things for all those who would follow Jesus. I listen to people give testimonies about how when I became a Christian, then all my fears and all my doubts and all my sorrows and all my griefs melted away in that moment of faith in Jesus Christ. I've never been fearful. I've never been sorry. I've never been doubtful ever again in all of my life. I admire people who have that great faith, but I can tell you it's not been my experience. Jesus knows what's going to happen tomorrow. And Jesus knows what he's going to do. Jesus knows where he's going. And Jesus knows what's going to happen. But I'm a follower of Jesus, and I have a fear of the unknown. I have fear of what's going to happen to me and what's going to happen to my family and what's going to happen to you, what's going to happen to our church, what's going to happen to our congregation. I still have fears. Do you ever have the what ifs? You know, sometimes what ifs can be some of the scariest, most frightening things in the world whenever you connect them with Jesus Christ. What if? And I imagine the what ifs had set in on these disciples when they saw the face of Jesus turned toward Jerusalem and they began to make footprints in the dust of the earth going toward Jerusalem. And Jesus has said, if you follow me, you got to give it all up, chuck it aside, and what you gain, you're going to gain with severe persecutions. And as they turned in that direction, their hearts began to beat faster, and they were gripped in fear because there was in their minds the what ifs of the unknown. What if I never see my family again? What if they arrest us? What if we're declared to be blasphemers? What if we're stoned to death? The what ifs can take a lot of joy out of life. What if I get sick? What if I lose my job? Now, not just out of coincidence, but what if I lose my job because I follow Jesus? What if I lose my job because I know what his word teaches and I forsake what his word teaches? What if? What if? What if? A lot of what ifs. And what ifs are scary. The very foundation of fear is generally what if. I was thinking the other day about some people I knew when I lived in Florida. And one of the things they did, and I'm thankful to God I never did this, and I always thought it was a contemptible thing, but sometimes they would find an out-of-state car in downtown Miami, something with New Jersey, New York, Vermont license plates. And they'd find what they assumed to be vulnerable people, a mom and dad on vacation. And they would, at night, when it was dark, they would follow those people just as closely as they could. And that's all they did. They just followed them as closely as they could. Wherever they went, they were right behind them. They never honked, never said a word, never offered any. And sometimes those people would become so filled with fear that they would just drive up to a service station or somewhere and just jump out and run. Hadn't been threatened. Nobody had said a word. You know what? What ifs had set in? What if they follow us home? What if they've got a gun? What if they rob us? What if they rape my wife of 40 years? What if? And the what ifs set in, and the what ifs had set in on the disciples and on the apostles. And Jesus does away with the what ifs and tells them exactly what is going to happen. Maybe that settles some of their fears. And we've got what ifs. Fear of failure. What if I get to Jerusalem and things get bad? I don't want to die. I don't want to be arrested. I don't want to be put in prison. What if I become a coward? And I have to go back home having forsaken this man that I love so very, very much. Rather than fail, I'd rather just turn around and go home now. It's really not worth the ridicule. It's not worth the guilt, the loss of my self-esteem to start this thing and then fail. How many times do I hear people say, well, I just can't begin the Christian life because I just know I'm so weak, I could never finish it. Sometimes we fear being successful. If I start it, it'll really work, and there I am. What will I do then? If I go to Jerusalem and I stand with Jesus Christ and I'm successful and I overcome these fears and this trepidation and I stand with him and he says he's going to be mocked and scourged and spit upon and then they're going to kill him, that means I'm going to be his companion. They'll do the same thing to me. What if I am successful? It's just death. And so there we are, fearing the unknown, unbelieving of the known, beset by what ifs, fearing failure, fearing success, and fearing men and what they will do to us. And I suppose we too could join them in their journey. Just beginning their journey of fear. Following Jesus fearfully. But there are some truths we have to accept. And that is, we share the emotions with many other people. We have to accept the fact that fear is acceptable in that we can work with it. Fear can be a terrible thing and is a terrible thing, but you can function. In fact, you may function better terrified. Don't be ashamed of being afraid, because you can follow Jesus in fear. I hear people tell me, well, when I got old, I grew so strong spiritually that I never feared again. I'm looking forward to the time when I get old. So that I'll not have any fears anymore. I haven't found that to be true. For the things to fear get multiplied in age. But I haven't quit following Jesus. We must recognize that we have a duty. And that duty is greater than our fears. We must recognize that we do have love for Jesus Christ. And I can imagine these people thinking as they sort of begin to drift back toward the back of the crowd, thinking this over, their eyes downcast, and they begin to think, and they see Jesus just a little more in the distance as they begin to sort of let their steps falter, and they linger, and they begin to think all these things, and the what ifs are there, and the unknown is there, and they're thinking about all these things, and then all of a sudden, just like a shot, like a bolt of lightning, they think, "But I love that man. I love that man. He has the words to eternal life. I am captured by his spirit. I am enamored of his body presence and of his kindness and his firmness, and I've never felt this way about a human in all of my existence, and how can I not follow him?" And so their steps gain a little momentum. Their steps get a little longer. And you know, I think their fears get a little less. And if you really want your fears to get sort of shaken down to where you don't really have that much of a problem, get to the head of the line. Crowd on up. Just crowd on up till you could reach out and touch him. Don't hang back to the back of the line, because it's going to get worse and your fears are going to increase. Crowd on up. Crowd on up to the Word of God. Crowd on up to the truths of God. And those fears will begin to diminish. And you can follow Jesus with comfort.